I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. We're rethinking our place in the world this time with Parag Khanna, who landed out of the blue two Sundays ago with a cover story in the New York Times Magazine that redrew the whole picture of American power. No more the hyperpower, no more the lord of a unipolar universe. He says we're just barely a superpower, more nearly a wounded giant in a three-way race with China, which has been getting rich at home and rampant in Latin America and Africa, as well as Asia. A race also with the European Union, which has been growing steadily by one country a year for years now. And Parag Khanna says, is the real model that the world wants to grow up and be. Parag Khanna, you're speaking live this hour to Professor James Dedarian's global media students at Brown University. Introduce us and them to this post-American world of yours.
Thanks so much, everybody, and it's great to be with you. Let me first say I'm a big fan of your professor, whose work I struggled to wrap my mind around not too many years ago when I was an undergraduate like you. And it was certainly worth the effort because we are, in fact, in the post-American and post-modern world that his writing very much captured before its time. The article that you've read is derived from my book, The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order, which is out in a month. It's the result of several years of hard sort of trekking and wandering and exploring about 40 countries, which I pre-identified as strategic places where American power could likely be seen to be declining, while at the same time one could see the influence of China and Europe, the European Union, rising. And that did indeed prove to be the case. And I think that the best way to understand the decline of American power is to go to these places. There were many more I could have chosen. There are others I could have chosen. But the point was that I chose ones that seem to be the most strategically significant or will be in the 21st century.
Take an example, Parag. Turkey, for example. You drove around Turkey or others, Russia, Venezuela.
Absolutely. There's so many. And, the book is divided into five different regions. And Turkey is constitutes the bulk of the first, which is Eastern Europe, and moving towards the Caucasus and the Caspian Sea. Now, Turkey is a country that had very strong relations with the United States via NATO during the Cold War and is, of course, a very geographically primely located country. But since the Iraq War, or even somewhat prior to, relations were very strained. And when Turkey denied basing access rights for the invasion of Iraq to the United States, Turkey was plunged into all kinds of anti-American hysteria and fits, many of which appeared, were justified by the Democratic electorate in saying that, we will not be muscled around and so forth. At the same time, however, what's important to note is that part of the motivation was that Europe was exercising a great deal of leverage and pressure on Turkey not to support the Iraq War because it might have hurt its efforts to join the European Union and Europeanize. At the same time this was just a microcosm of a much deeper sort of trend, which was the economic relationship between the European Union and Turkey, which has been deepening for 40 years. The fact is that European investment and trade and the broader demographic relationship with Turkey is so much deeper than America's alliance with Turkey had ever been. And that is something to do with geography, but it has an equal amount to do with the many levels of the relationship that Europe has developed with Turkey, whereas America's relationship with Turkey was quite singular or one-dimensional. And I think that's important to realize because when we think about American power in the world, inertia dictates our thinking far too much. We assume that because America has been preponderant in certain places that that will continue, and we ignore the many ways, such as economic relationships and otherwise, the many ways in which, in fact, our hegemony has been eroding without us actually noticing it. And so Turkey provides a good example of that.
I want to ask James Dedarian to put this thinking in context, but could I get in two questions first? Whatever happened to Russia? I mean, even students here can remember a world that was us against the commies and a bristling, massive nuclear standoff that could have gone on forever. Whatever happened to Moscow? Barely makes your map.
Right. It's a great question. No, in fact, it makes the map. It makes the geographic map. But in all the other maps, it fails to congeal and be a coherent entity. And I'll explain. I mean, at the end of the Cold War, of course, and since then, has revealed how hollow, in a way, Soviet power and the Soviet Empire was, at least internally. And what we've seen since then is, the decline of the Russian population, the exposure of how weak and crumbling its infrastructure is, and how little state control there really is over this vast geography. So on the map, Russia is so crucial to my picture of the world in my book that I have to give it two entirely separate chapters because it fits such completely different geographic spaces and regional realms by which people sort of divide up the world. So as a geographic feature, it's incredibly important. But as a geopolitical entity, it's schizophrenic. It conducts relations with the East, with China, with Korea, with Japan, that operate according to one set of rules, and with Europe on another set. And then in pipeline politics, there's a whole third set of considerations and rules and motivations. So I find it to be a very schizophrenic, internally divided, and weak polity. On the strategic level, in the short term, people believe that because, as I say, Gazprom dominates the foreign policy, all of a sudden there's this resurgence. But I think that's a very short-term view of Russia as a broad geographic and political entity, which I think is ever weakening.
To me, the other interesting missing piece, if I may say, is Israel, partly because it's In American politics, it is a kind of 51st state, a permanent friend of the United States, but also a kind of model in the political discussion of what this country, ours, is up against in the Islamo-fascism or militant Islam. Where is Israel in your picture of first, second, and third worlds? Or the new geostrategy? Yeah.
Right. I mean, I include Israel, obviously, in my broader Middle East chapter. I don't treat it as the eastern frontier of Western civilization, which is kind of how some of its politicians see it. And certainly the way, as you've caricatured some of the mainstream views, it is perceived as being in the U.S. I can't say for sure where it is in 20, 30, 40 years' time. I've gotten a lot of emails asking that in the last week or so. And to that, I don't have an answer. What I can say is that it, too, plays many sides. And one of the main themes I try to capture in the book is the way in which every country really is hedging its bets. And Israel is no different. I can simply point out that, Israel has a very special defense relationship with the United States, where it is able to procure advanced technology and even co-develop it, which it then in turn sells to China, which every bit as much is perceived in a potential enemy as Israel is perceived a friend. And then what China does with some of that technology and weaponry is to sell it to Iran, which then in turn points it back at Israel or at the United States and its allies. So what you see when you analyze what Israel is perceived as versus what it does and what it is as a sort of autonomous actor are two very, very different things. And I think that it's one of the few countries in the world where whose future is so uncertain that I can't give an answer as to what it will be, what it will look like, and what its orientation is going to be geopolitically with any certainty.
Professor James Dudarian, would you put Parag Khanna in context? Where is he coming from? Why haven't we heard this before in the Times or in the presidential campaign?
Well, I think one of the main reasons is that Parag does an incredible job of talking about power in ways that we haven't seen in the presidential campaign or by a lot of the self-declared international experts, and why this is such an incredibly fresh new perspective. So I really want to ask you about your notion of power. Obviously, you see it being distributed in new ways that others have not perceived by virtue of you being on the ground, by virtue of your methodology. You have some keen insights about that. But also almost the sort of Foucauldian notion you have that every new kind of power produces new kinds of resistance. and also new kinds of resistance that produce new kinds of power. And we're seeing that being played out on the international arena. So my first sort of, you know, question to you would be, what do you think is the most powerful form of power today? I'd like to see us retire forever the concept of soft power.
Right.
But I doubt that's going to happen, but I hope this article goes somewhere towards that by its sophistication. But I'm just curious, where do you see, are you like a geopolitical maven in the sense that you think that still power can be reduced to territory or to some sort of material might? Or is it more cultural in form, more political in form? Where that's my first question, of where do you come down on the type of power that's having its remapping effect on the global order?
Right. It's interesting. There's obviously deep conceptual and methodological and theoretical tensions between those who emphasize traditional geopolitics and territoriality in their work and then those who focus on globalization. And like a good student of Derridean, I try and transcend it. It wasn't originally what I set out to do, but I felt it to be necessary actually along the way. Originally, yes, as a student of geopolitics, I wanted to prove or demonstrate that geography still matters. I wanted to write a book from the inside out about these places and say, if you were this country, how could you think like a country? It would probably begin with, where are you? Who are your neighbors? What is your place? What is your geography? And I still feel that that's central. At the same time, geopolitics that has been this dominant notion governing interpretations of world history and rise and decline of empires for many, many years, I feel has been replaced as the meta-narrative or meta-principle of global politics by globalization. And that, to me, it represents a massive sort of evolution in thinking, potentially. Of course, globalization is a term that no one likes to use anymore. I mean, to answer the question about power, in a way, globalization is the most powerful form of it. But, of course, it's used in so many ways. But the fact that it is if territory was the sort of key power variable in the geopolitical worldview, then in the age of globalization, it's manipulating the access across space that proves to be the greatest factor in determining power relations. So at the same time, again, as I was saying, because globalization means everything and nothing, I also realize that, well, who are the most powerful actors in a globalized world? It still seems to be the actors that geopolitics would predict are powerful, which are territorially based imperial entities.
Well, let me press you on that.
Those.
Mm-hmm. Let me press you on that a bit, that particular point, because I'm with you so far as we've moved from, you know, bipolarity, as Chris was describing it in the worst old days of the Cold War, to multipolarity. But I think this idea that states are territorially bounded powers are still as important. Wouldn't someone like bin Laden, as a sort of a super empowered individual, someone who has access to, you know, new technologies but also old fundamentalist beliefs, sort of contest this view that territory matters? Isn't, you know, the virtual jihad proof of that?
Well, the virtual jihad is obviously a force in the world, and it exists certainly across territory. It exists as an idea. It exists as a political sort of vehicle. But how much power does it have? It certainly doesn't have the power that Islam itself has. And if you treat the two both in terms of their ideational power, bin Laden represents a small fraction of what Islam's total power is. So I don't ascribe to bin Laden as an individual or to al-Qaeda a great deal of power as such. So in that sense, I agree that one could still say that territorially rooted powers have a certain foundational or reliable power or capacity that others still don't have. I mean, I would say that certain transnational corporations have achieved a greater amount of leverage and power over the state form than bin Laden has.
Could I ask, Parag, just a fundamental old-fashioned question about what dimensions of American power have declined? I mean, our military budget and machinery is still incomparable in the world. We think of ourselves as having big-time cultural power, Hollywood, pop music, rock and roll, rap, CNN, that realm. We also like to think of ourselves as having kind of pre-Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, certainly good guy power, just, you know, baseball, sports value sort of thing. And we also have liked to think that our antiquity as a democracy, a functioning democracy, is part of our kind of worldwide charm. Go through the list. I mean, where did we fall off?
Sure. I would say the decline, again, is relative, and that's what's essential. I mean, studying geopolitics is about understanding broader trends. And as I say in my article, there are statistics and there are trends. Statistically, yes, military power, in terms of military expenditure, the United States is still, spends as much as the rest of the world combined or something incredibly lopsided like that. But then you have to ask, well, what does it achieve? Which of America's foreign policy objectives, which have been pursued by military means, have been achieved in the past 8 years?
You say none.
The answer, obviously. Well, yes, exactly. So it's what is it for? One can spend a lot, but the question is not so much what is spent. That's the wrong metric to use. It's what works. Economic power, again, relatively speaking, America's share of the global economy is declining, which is commensurate to the rise of other entities, China and the European Union, for example. Cultural power, again, American cultural power or soft power, and James, I certainly hate the term as much as you do, is still considered broad.
What's wrong with soft power?
Well, it's one of these words that absorbs so much meaning that it's devoid of meaning. It's a sponge term.
Tsunami relief, or is it Hollywood, or what?
Well,
tsunami relief is a smart strategy. Really, it's actually a humanitarian delivery. It's what I call diplomacy of the deed. Yeah. It isn't actually all that soft.
Exactly.
I'm still puzzled why we don't hear. I mean, let me just say, I've been waiting to hear these views, this fear of empire and decline for all through the Bush administration. Why don't we read it in the New York Times? And why hasn't any of the candidates on either side of the fight for the presidency sort of embraced this grand old warning from John Adams and Ben Franklin and George Washington, beware the Republican... lowercase Republican temptations to go exactly this way. Do you understand this, James?
I mean,
do you understand my question?
Well, I guess the question is this idea of taking virtue on bayonet point. This idea that you can somehow take democracy by battalion to other lands. What's your take on that,
Parag?
Well, I mean, evidence obviously speaks for itself. It doesn't work. What I talk about in the article in the book is that success is the greatest motivator. It's not democracy, capitalism, or any other ism. It's just succeeding by any means necessary. And that's, again, why I emphasize geography and mentality so much in the countries that I try to psychoanalyze in this book. It's what do they feel is the next most achievable step for them. I talk about Maslow and the hierarchy of need in my book, and how, in a way, if a country were a person, it would seek to satisfy its needs and to move up the tree or the pyramid. And one can only hope to attain what is reachable at any given stage. So that's why it's difficult enough to imagine certain countries or societies simply wanting to emulate or replicate American democracy right away. It's that much more unfathomable that it could then just simply be imposed from the outside. So it's so sort of, ontologically improbable and unrealistic that I'm not surprised. And then, I mean, it goes to your point, Chris, if they had any memory or historical understanding of the founding fathers and of these warnings that have been issued for centuries, perhaps this might not have happened.
James?
Real quick one on the geopolitical. I'm going to push you on this one more time because... I'm going to put my POMO hat on to sort of challenge you on, because others have said that geopolitics has diminished as chronopolitics has grown, in the sense that time, the sort of temporality of the event, is as important as the event itself. And in particular, since we're in a class about global media, how quickly the image can determine the interpretation of the event. The media is no longer simply the transmitter of events, but actually the trigger. And real time is the new sort of, you know, currency, the gold currency of politics. Doesn't that diminish the significance of geopolitics with chronopolitics ascendant?
I think the two go hand in hand. If the media is a trigger for an event or an action, the vehicle is still often the traditional geopolitical vehicles of conflict, of action, so to speak. So one of the first examples, obviously, is or has been in the 90s of sort of chronopolitics and the power of the media, the notion of humanitarian intervention and the power of the image to sort of motivate. But what is it that was intended to be motivated? It was strategic, military, international intervention and action of the form that one might have expected in with perhaps different motivations or triggers in a non-media dominated world. Now, another reason why I don't think the views are inconsistent is because, again, if globalization, of which, of course, the media and the image and the chronopolitics are a part, is the new defining kind of, you know, meta principle or foundation of geopolitical activity, the globalization may have subsumed geopolitics, and geopolitics operates within a globalized world, in a media world and so forth, but it hasn't eradicated geopolitics.
Parag, could I go back to your remark that success is the great motivator? It's not about ideology or maybe anything else. You make two points I'd love you to explain and defend. One, that to the second world, Europe is the political model. Parliamentary systems, not strongman presidential rule. That's a blow to our political ego. And then there's this other matter. You say that for the second world, Lee Kuan Yew and Singapore is the definition of victory. To go from third world to absolutely the front row of the first world in 40, 50 years. Take those two points and explain how they work, especially this matter that we may have lost the race to be the political model for the whole wide world.
Absolutely. Those are two of my personal favorites, if you will, if I'm allowed to have my own favorites for my own book. But it's certainly something that has just come across so viscerally in my travels, and that has been such a blind spot of ours that it's genuinely remarkable. Now, I would urge you all, by the way, to pick up today's New York Times and note the op-ed that talks about Karzai's weakening administration and the ways in which the presidential system that we supported with Karzai at the top have failed to produce the kind of political stability. Now, that is one absolutely perfect example of what I'm talking about. There, the authors recommend that a more devolved parliamentary system, of course, along European lines, would be more appropriate to maintain a broader political base and stability and spirit of compromise rather than the current system they have, which is presidential and where Karzai is viewed as a weak strongman, so to speak. So that's just one example. But you notice this in other places as well. Why would we want, if you look at the revolutions in Eastern Europe, all of the so-called color revolutions, what happened in quite a few of them is that, you know, a bad system was overthrown in a so-called rose revolution or orange revolution. And who came in? Someone who was a sort of democratic strongman. We had a presidential system in Ukraine. In Georgia, Saakashvili also, wanted or is leading a presidential order. Huge protests against both of them because they are not, parliamentary systems which would have broader buy-in and allow a greater amount of the population or diverse political voices to be represented. So in a way, it's been a mistake in those countries to pursue the American model. It has led to highly unpopular systems. Now take the Middle East, where all you have is strongman rule. Why would it be much of an evolution to have just another set of strongmen in a slightly modified system? Probably not, because that's of course what they already have. So there again, a European style parliamentary system would be favorable. There's so many examples around the world that it becomes almost hard to refute that parliamentary systems would be more appropriate than presidential ones in the developing world. So that's on that one. On Singapore and Lee Kuan Yew, whose memoirs are appropriately titled From Third World to First, or at least one volume of them. He was quite prolific, about three volumes in his autobiography. There, you know, it's something that just, again, the more one travels, the more one hears it. Sort of, you know, Lee Kuan Yew was here, or the Singaporean delegation were here, and we're following them, we're copying them from Dubai to Kazakhstan. One wants to find a niche in the global economy and gear a society around becoming a productive component of that global economy and profiting and prospering. And Singapore is rightly seen as having done that most quickly, efficiently, and successfully.
It's an interesting. Could I just say it's especially interesting because it's a more complex mix than we realize sometimes. It's a nanny state, incredibly regulated. Whether it's overhead monitors of how fast and far you're driving, or to the ethnic and racial integration of housing projects on every floor. At the same time, it's a kind of rugged Chinese capitalism, too. Are people following that whole model, sort of rough capitalism and nanny state, too?
Right. I mean, there's only one other place attempting to emulate the Singaporean model that is actually comparable in population size and political autonomy, a sort of city-state, and that's Dubai. Every other place is not a place that's, geographically or demographically or culturally even capable of doing it. It's become basically just a moniker or a philosophy or just a general direction rather than an attempt to sort of be a carbon copy. And, of course, it's more something that societies or leaders in other countries try to import rather than something that Singapore is actively been exporting. And I think people, pick and choose from the model sort of a la carte what they can. And then, of course, there's the fact that, Kazakhs and Emiratis and many other societies who talk about this haven't actually gone there. So they're not even aware of a lot of the things that you mentioned that are some of the, less, tasteful aspects of the nanny state.
I'm dying to ask, who is Parag Khanna? How do you work? You talk about driving across Turkey and listening, but I kept wondering, who's he talking to? Are you talking to students? Are you talking to bankers? Are you talking to American diplomats? What's the method here?
Right. It's funny, I started to think about this question when people were asking, who is your book for? And my answer was, can you read? because I'd never really thought about, who. I certainly wanted to write a book for college students because I thought, what would I want to read? What do I wish I would have read freshman year in college in IR 101 when I had to buy 15 books? What would be one of those? And I certainly wanted to be sort of accessible at that level, but also kind of fun. But in terms of the methodology, I didn't ever want to leave a country till I had the picture through their eyes, and that's something that I emphasize. So I didn't have a set timeline. I didn't go only to the capital city. I didn't meet only with government leaders. I just went and talked to everyone I could until I felt like I had the picture, until the value added, if you will, of each additional conversation was becoming negligible. And that really did mean journalists, students, political leaders, academics, the proverbial taxi driver, although they weren't so proverbial, I really did talk to a lot of taxi drivers. A lot of taxi drivers did take me around. I did get lost a lot when I was driving. Almost all of the research was done really on the ground. I would go to a region and just drive through the countries or hitchhike or whatever.
But then how do you figure out, is China winning or is Europe coming back wherever I am, or how's the U.S. doing? What are the clues?
Yeah, and it's measured in so many different ways. In the Andes, where you don't expect to see China, it's one metric of it is noticing the flood of Chinese goods in the markets, and the various discussions about Chinese laborers that have come in to work on a dam project or something. So there you start to get a hint about it and you do some investigation. In Europe, it's talk about, wow, there's a new Peugeot factory that's just opened up over here. So, for example, in Egypt, and how, Europeans are providing more jobs. It's the discussions about European money going to support political parties in various North African countries and so on. So that's one indicator. And there's so many different metrics of power and influence, and you should not rule any out. I try to create an aggregate picture of the ways in which places are being Sinified, Europeanized, or Americanized. Mm. And not necessarily how that is zero sum, but how those overlap. And the main message isn't so much this sort of rigid return to multipolarity as it is something about a broader set of overlapping influences. And that's why I talk about sort of the Venn diagram of geopolitics being very fuzzy, because this has become a very multi-layered and multi-dimensional kind of situation.
James Dudarian.
Well, I have to. Chris allows me at every opportunity to drop in my concept of heteropolarity, because I think multipolarity still...
Between consenting adults, right.
Yes, between consenting adults. it's really the case that multipolarity still carries with it that notion of fairly equal partners or relative homogeneity of actors, while the hetero, which always gets Chris very excited when I use it, is really more of a sense that you have a lot of different actors at different levels who are on the world stage that have some sort of global impact, be it because of, you know, force multiplying effects of media and new technologies, the Al Jazeera effect, the CNN effect. But I'm just curious whether or not the what I see as a heteropolarity is on the ascendant in your schema, on your map, or do you see it as just being replaced by the old balance of power?
Right. It's a great question. In a way, from that point of view, this is a very bad book about globalization and power, because it is so rooted in looking at the rise and fall of influence of traditional territorial actors and empires such as Europe, China, and the U.S. So one way to answer is to say that's what my next book is about, which is true. But the other way is to say that these heterogeneous actors of different types are somehow connected to or agents of the major powers as I see them, and in a way that influence is used. And one of the main points I try and make is that there is no one globalization. There is a globalization with American characteristics that is serving in a way as an agent of American imperial expansion. And there is a European way of doing globalization and a Chinese way of doing it with its own characteristics. So many of the actors in this heteropolitical or heteropolar world can also be interpreted as being agents within that broader imperial framework. Now, having said that, I equally favor, from a geopolitical standpoint, seeing the world as apolar, which is something that Niall Ferguson has written about. So I almost repent the notion of having posited a tripolarity from the point of view of aggregate power, and rather saying that because there will not be one single hegemon, it is in a way an apolar world, a nonpolar world, which really opens up one's mind or mental frame to this heteropolar world of multiple actors competing on all different levels. And in a way, that is what I'd like to emphasize more, because whereas the article and the intro and the conclusion of the book are about this broader framework question, you know, 4/5 of it is about going through all of these different societies and countries where you see a much more complex and layered view of what power is, how it operates, who has it, what kinds of actors, and so forth. So I'd rather that people, in fact, come away with this notion of the complexities and many levels and layers of power, rather than this notion that in country X, it's simply a matter of measuring Chinese power, European power, and American power, and that will tell us what the risk board looks like in the 21st century.
Yeah, your invocation of Ferguson's apolarity reminded me of something that Derrida said, that really the whole history of Western metaphysics is a substitutions of one center for another center. Now, we start off with a god, one god. We start off with one emperor being enough to, you know, keep order. And now, with the proliferation of, you know, gods, emperors, or the decline, what do you see filling the next center at a metaphysical level? I know this is sort of a big question for a geopolitical thinker, but you seem to like the big questions.
I do. I'm not sure if I, and I certainly don't sufficiently answer that question in the book, and as to what single principle or ideology. I think the closest I come is to arguing that globalization is that. It's the one thing that everyone understands, because everyone can, in fact, understand in their own way. It is, you know, sort of globalization as God, rather than it's a step, it's an evolved step beyond thinking that empires rise and decline in a fatalistic kind of way and one is a sort of tool of history. I think it's a step beyond that, but it seems to put power or identity more in people's hands, because that is in a way one of the consequences of globalization, people believing that they could be what they want to be, reach out around the world to whomever they want, build alliances with whomever they want anywhere through the internet in terms of building their identity, sharing financial flows and so forth. So this sort of decentralized, globalized world empowers everyone, but everyone seems to realize that globalization is what has empowered them.
Paragon, whatever happened to the clash of civilizations, of faiths and family connections?
It never really entered my my calculus in doing this project. It never became the paradigm for me. So whatever happened to it is to assume that it ever happened. I don't believe it ever did. And it can be so easily dismissed in ways that not many people who comment on Huntington's thesis ever do, but which is simply that empires have always been bigger than civilizations. They've always been more powerful. They always transcend and cut across civilizations. It was perhaps never a good idea to even use that framework to begin with, let alone reducing that further to religion.
One of the pleasures of your work, it seems to me, is that it's a kind of competition without hatred or without fierceness. It's any number can play. If the Chinese won't deal, maybe the Europeans will, or try the Americans, or come back next week. But it's not. It's not a clash.
It seems more like a celebration rather than a fear of differences.
It sounds like a three-ring circus in which everybody's having kind of a good time and everybody gets a shot.
It's amazing. I'll tell you one thing that I kept hearing in every country in the world is, we'll do it our way. And of course, they weren't coordinating that statement. But I would hear in Kazakhstan, there will be a Kazakh way. And you go to India today and hear, we're going to do it the Indian way. And literally everywhere, in Brazil most certainly, there's a Brazilian way. And every country has declared that they are finding or have the outlines of their own way. And in a way, the book tries to explain that, if not celebrate it. But I think it's a very important sort of realization, because it, rather than go into countries informed by an attitude that says which hegemony or which superpower is going to dominate this place, you start to appreciate that actually they feel that they will do it their way, no matter who's no matter who appears to be in charge from a geopolitical standpoint.
Speaking of India, and I gather you were born there.
Yes.
India sort of drops out of the front of the race. India figures less largely in your scheme of things than it does, say, in Tom Friedman's. Explain that.
Sure. There's far too many reasons to really go into, but I'll try and capture it as quickly as I can. First of all, in geopolitics, there's something, as in business, there's first mover advantage. China has gotten there first, and by there I mean a lot of the countries where India would like to see a greater amount of influence in its own neighborhood and beyond elsewhere in the world. And it's doing a very robust and aggressive job of maintaining those relationships to the detriment of India's efforts and appeals. So number two, India is, in fact, if you look at it, a peninsula surrounded by, three sides by ocean, and on the other and to the north by the Himalayan mountains, the tallest mountain range in the world, and also by failed states or enemies like Pakistan, Nepal and Bangladesh. So its power projection capabilities are going to be limited quite literally forever, more or less, except for the fact that India is in a way a country that is, as I said earlier, trying to do things its own way, and it believes that it will extend its power by globalization through, chronopolitics, economic relationships, and, of course, through its own cultural affinities and exports. So it is certainly more visible around the world than one would expect the largest, poor country in the world to be. And that is most definitely a function of its own unique way of approaching and leveraging globalization. But is it a major geopolitical actor, strategically and decisively extending its influence around the world and changing decisions and patterns and activities outside of its own immediate domain, the answer is actually no, not at all and not even close.
Parikhana, there are students here who want their moment. Step right up and fire away.
When reading your piece, one line jumped out where you cited a Malaysian diplomat who talked about it being easier to form communities among brown and yellow people as opposed to white. And how do you think a Barack Obama presidency could shift those perceptions?
It's funny. I've had a lot of people have written me emails saying, having read your piece, I feel like I need to support the Obama campaign, which is obviously not something that I advocated in the piece, though I would personally. But I don't know what Obama's real diplomatic style is going to be. I know what he says he's going to be, but he doesn't say that he's going to be much different from what any other sensible person would say who's trying to be elected president in terms of outreach and alliances. The brown and the yellow, but not the white. I mean, the diplomat was obviously referring to the East Asian kind of realm and architecture, where he was basically saying, he foresees greater collaboration with India and Japan and China, but not so much with Australia and the U.S., which he obviously considers, white Anglosphere, in other words. And I don't think that the Obama administration or any other administration would have to do more, obviously, than have its have a different skin color to impact that general sense of Asia for Asians, as I call it, in my book. And that what that hinges on is obviously a multi-prong approach that the United States would have to take in terms of developing more sophisticated and multi-level relationships with ASEAN, ASEAN Plus 3, the ASEAN Regional Forum, the East Asian community, and a variety of other institutions that are in the region. It would take a lot more than just a shift in image to reinsert America as a factor in those diplomatic processes that are so well underway.
From the student ranks, another question.
Hi, my name's Christina. I graduated last year. I was an international relations concentrator. So my question for you is that in your article, you do place, and as you've said today, a pretty large emphasis still on geopolitics. Yet toward the end of your article, you talk about this need to build a diplomatic industrial complex. Sort of given the decline of diplomacy in the last 8 years, I'm just sort of wondering what recommendations you would make for public diplomacy and its future or potential.
Sure. Again, public diplomacy is one of these terms like soft power that I think has been carved out as a niche unto itself and thereby been crippled as a result of being conceptually isolated from what it is. There is no such thing as public diplomacy, and that's why I sort of dismiss it in the piece. I say, take care of this in terms of, performing diplomacy of the deed, and the public diplomacy will take care of itself. One cannot just improve one's image just by saying one's image has changed. One has to do certain things, and those deeds are diplomatic deeds. So I can't emphasize enough the extent to which the last 5, 6, 7 years of debates about public diplomacy in America and how to revamp it, and the countless studies and reams of paper that have gone into them in Washington and all of these groups that have been run by the State Department think tanks, and I've been a part of a bunch of them, how utterly useless they all are. And that should worry everyone in the room and everyone in the country, because it's a lot of money and a lot of time being spent by a lot of very senior people who have really been wasting that time and money. They have not come up with the kind of solutions, and which I, again, simply sum up as a diplomatic industrial complex in terms of it really advancing the presence of whatever engagement, positive engagement there is from American society as a whole internationally. As I mentioned in the article, its foundations, corporate entrepreneurs, philanthropists, and so on and so on, that is the best form of diplomacy. And that none of that stuff falls under the rubric of what is today called public diplomacy, because public diplomacy is mostly discussed in terms of just rhetoric, framing, messaging, and so on. And so it's completely damned, and it's the wrong conceptual approach to have. It's the wrong bureaucratic structure behind it. And so I would lobotomize the current structure of the State Department along these sort of public diplomacy cones and lines as they
presently we're changing
are.
The language as we speak. Chronopolitics is in, public diplomacy is out. Next question.
Hi, my name is Josh Sargent. I'm a sophomore at Brown. My question is that many thinkers who argue for a continued American dominance argue that China and the European Union face incredible demographic problems that will prevent them ultimately from surpassing the United States. And I'm curious about how you respond to that.
Which demographic problems do you mean?
Specifically aging populations.
Okay.
Right. These things operate on different on varying time horizons. First of all, it really ties very strongly into the, I think the first question that you have to ask to answer that is what is European and what is Chinese? Because if European is not white Christians, Western European sort of club, and if European is a way of life and a certain ethos in that Roman imperial sense to which I do ascribe at least in an aspirational or evolutionary way to Europe, well, then, in fact, Europe doesn't have demographic problems because it is moving eastward into younger societies. Ukraine has a population of 50 million that's mostly young. It has a sort of Arab demographic profile in terms of having a youth bulge. If Turks can understand themselves as European, well, then you have another 80 million people and a very healthy, robust population that is seeing itself as European and so on. You have a few countries in Western Europe with declining populations, but the population of the European Union as a political entity is obviously growing every year as it incorporates new countries, and it's far larger than the United States. So the only way to answer the question, you have to first answer what is a European. I'm defining it in a political, economic, and norm-oriented kind of way, which is much easier, which is obviously supports my argument a lot more that I wouldn't worry so much about the demographic decline of a few specific societies and focus more on the identity of who Europeans are, in which case the population is growing quite significantly. For China, one has a sort of similar approach. The population of there is obviously aging in the Han Chinese society itself, and there is obviously a debate out there as to whether China can grow rich fast enough to support that population. And then, there, of course, there's also the gender imbalance in Chinese society. There's a lot of things that China is attempting to do. First of all, of course, the social welfare systems that it is developing to support its aging population, the export of a lot of Chinese people into peripheral countries in the region to work for or as agents of China, or just sending them out to find work because they may not have it in China itself. And certainly the growing presence of Chinese in Africa and elsewhere is a small way of mitigating the population sort of overflow. Then there is the importation of women that happens in China from Vietnam, from Korea, from Burma, and from elsewhere, which is another way in which China is attempting to go about creating a demographic stability in the sort of gender sense. Then there's again this question of identity. I mean, the resurgence of Chinese ethnic identity around the region, creating this sense of Chineseness, gives a totally opposite sense to what you're implying. It gives a sense of great vitality, in a way, to Chinese identity and those who identify themselves as Chinese, and a more subtle picture of how demography, identity, ethnicity, and so forth interact. So there are certainly demographic stresses, but one could not use the term decline to refer to either the European or Chinese populations from my point of view, because they're, of course, both far, far larger than that of the United States and are growing.
Parag, two more questions and we'll wrap it up.
Hi, my name is Amy Tan and I'm a junior at Brown University. And I have a question regarding John Eikenberry's article in the last issue of Foreign Affairs entitled Can the Liberal System Survive? In it, he argues that the Western liberal order is very well equipped to accommodate the rise of new powers like China. And I was wondering if you could respond to the quotation, "The key thing for U.S. leaders to do is to remember that it may be possible for China to overtake the U.S. alone, but it is much less likely that China will ever manage to overthrow the Western order." What do you think about this?
I don't think that China has to overthrow the Western order. In a way, the Western order, if it remains only a Western order, is going to depose itself because the world is much larger than the West. Western norms and the dominance of its institutions and models are already fading, partially as a result of the rise of China, but also sort of under their own weight and the internal stresses of the way in which the EU and the US compete as distinct models. So I'm not so sure what that Western order is at this point. What it was is clear to all of us who've studied, you know, sort of Cold War history and the rise of multilateralism and so forth. But what really is, and that's, I think it's one of the weaknesses of the article, which I've also read, which is not quite clearly defining what embodies that Western order today. What is the physical, institutional embodiment of that order today? If it's the multilateral institutions, which I argue are very, very weak and fading, then there isn't anything for China to overthrow. If it's something else that is being created, he hasn't identified what that is. He happens to be someone who is arguing on behalf of a coalition of democracies within the United Nations and other similar kinds of parallel bodies that would maintain Western values in an international institutional context. But those institutions have not yet come into being, and they may not. So again, I don't think that there is a Western order for China to have to overthrow in the first place. I believe that China is creating or leading in the development of Asian systems that simply exist for themselves, and that Western order seems to have diminishing relevance to them.
Hmm. Last question from these wonderful students.
Hi, my name is Jessica Carey, and I'm a senior at Brown. Christopher Lydon asked what kinds of U.S. power are diminishing in the last few years, and I would like to know the opposite. From your travels and one-on-one talks with people around the world, what is your impression of the kinds of political or cultural or other power that the U.S. continues to yield that will make it a viable node in this tripolarity that you talk about?
Be it noted that the Boston athletic teams are doing quite well. The Red Sox are up. The Patriots almost won. The Celtics are virtually undefeated. There's rising power for you.
Well, this is obviously the greatest irony of all, but it's the military. Because the military is seen as part of the cause, in a way, of the perceived decline of American influence, because it has failed in the way in which it's defined its missions in the venues that it has decided to intervene in. But it is the globally most sort of globally active American presence or entity or vehicle or arm. It can still do a great deal, and it is still called upon in counterterrorism operations and struggles all over the world, where it partners with police forces and militaries from Morocco to Indonesia, and there it's in some quarters considered a very important partner, and so it's actually welcome in certain ways. And of course, in humanitarian operations, we talked about the tsunami earlier, and there will be others. So the potential leadership of the military in the delivery of humanitarian assistance is another area where one can see an American footprint or fingerprint on something that improves America's image around the world. And in some ways, the military is attempting to transform itself or parts of itself to be more responsive and capable in those areas. And of course, peacekeeping and other sorts of things, humanitarian interventions as they may arise or become more frequent to the extent that the normative environment allows. So the military is well positioned potentially, to answer your question, to be perceived as a positive force, certainly in more domains and along greater dimensions than it presently is. So I would cautiously, in a way, answer the question by saying that the military, ironically, has the potential to be that force that you're looking to see. Mm. And the other is obviously the private sector, the ways in which American corporations are investing in entrepreneurial activities around the world. If the way in which they do that in terms of the way they partner and the amount of jobs they create and so forth, if that changes from the present mode, then they themselves and quote unquote American globalization could be perceived as more of a force for good than a force for exploitation, as they have been to date.
Professor Dedarian.
Yeah, one last question, just sparked by this remark you've made about the military superiority of the United States. And whether or not you're describing it or actually prescribing it as a positive alternative, given this one peculiar line, perhaps the most tendentious one in your article, that surely got the dander of Condi Rice up when you said the U.S. should pentagonize. No, what's the word you used?
Pentagonize.
I love that. Pentagonize the State Department. Explain that.
Just regional commands or something?
Yeah, the world is a very big and messy and complicated place, and I think that we would be more successful if we had subtle and regionally calibrated strategies for geographic areas rather than believing that democracy, liberty, freedom, whatever the case may be, is going to be a single global dominant principle. In a way, the Pentagon thinks in this way. Its regional commands are very powerful. It doesn't believe that there is, in a way, the military doesn't act as if there is one world. It acts as if there are multiple theaters of operation activity. And, of course, you know, it's created a separate Africa command now, realizing the strategic importance of Africa and the ways in which one needs specific strategies. That has not been the case with the State Department and diplomacy. You know, principles have been imposed from above, and in order to get funding for programs, one has to sort of, you know, find ways to integrate that party line into the regional diplomatic frames. But that's a very hard fit. And it hasn't worked. So in a way, whereas the word pentagonize almost connotes centralized strength and sort of a unified command, I actually mean the exact opposite, which is mean to decentralize and on a country by country, region by region basis, have a more calibrated diplomacy.
Well, thanks for that clarification,
Paragana. This is so interesting. We haven't said much about what's to be done about any of this decline, but can I just throw you a last observation with a question on the end? It seems to me hugely interesting, just on the media trend line, that 5 years ago, just before the start of the war in Iraq, the New York Times cover story in the magazine written by Michael Ignatieff was headlined, "The American Empire, Get Used to It." 5 years later, the same magazine has you writing a piece or excerpting your book on the incredible shrinking superpower. My question is, what's involved in that kind of reverse field in maybe the most influential of our media, and what would it take for this understanding to penetrate the political campaign, where still none dare call it empire, and none would dare speak of a decline of anything American to this point?
Right, they certainly won't. I don't think any of the campaigns are going to take slip into this, that sort of controversial language. Although, you know, Mitt Romney just yesterday in some press conference did have a line which was surprising because I don't think he's ever spoken like this before, where he said, "And so we have to restore American leadership because we don't want to see China or Europe become the next dominant superpower." So that's the closest anyone has come. The closest anyone, any candidate has come to even talking about Europe really is Barack Obama, because he's at least uttered the words European Union, which no other candidate has. He seems to recognize that it has some value and meaning in the world, which is more than I can say for some of the others. But, you know, the fact that 5 years ago a completely antithetical vision of America's role in the world was portrayed in the magazine and now mine has come doesn't lead me to assume that one was right, the other was wrong. It kind of leads me to wonder what will be the cover 5 years from now. And that's a question on which I think we should probably all just sort of give some thought.
Maybe Professor James Dedarian will write it.
Hope so.
One of these students might just write it. Parag Khanna, this is hugely interesting. We'd love to do it again and again. I want to thank you, Professor Dedarian, all the students in the class. Parag Khanna's new book is to be called The Second World, due out in March. We can't wait to see the whole thing. Thank you all.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation for Radio Open Source. Listener comments are part of the action on our website at www.radioopensource.org. Please join us early and often in your own words and your own wisdom. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for taking part in this conspiracy of the curious. This is Open Source.